Okay. So shall we start? Yeah? Is that a good time to start? Yeah? Okay. Let's start then. If it is a good time to start, we shall start. So, this is the sutta we're going to do today. Is a continuation of the sutta I started, a month ago or something? So, was anyone not here at that last sutta? Yeah, everybody was here? Not everybody? No? Okay. So some of you were not here. Okay, three of you were not here as well. Have you got the... Can you read the sutta up here? Or have you got the... No, it doesn't matter. I will give a quick... Yeah, it doesn't matter. You'll be fine here, I think. Yeah, I'll give a quick review of what we did last time, and then we'll continue with the last part of it. So this sutta is from the Anguttara Nikaya, the tens, number 61. It's called the Avijja Sutta in Pali, which means something like the sutta on ignorance, delusion, not understanding, not seeing things as they actually are, etc. And what this sutta does, it starts off with ignorance, and then it traces back the causes of that ignorance. And so it brings it back, stage by stage, all the way back to the very beginning. So what ignorance actually comes from. And one of the interesting things is that as it traces it back, right, it starts off by saying that ignorance has a nutriment, and the nutriment for ignorance is the five hindrances. And it says that nutriment for the five hindrances are the three kinds of bad conduct, right, body, speech, and mind. And then the nutriment for that is then it has the non-restraint of the sense faculties, nutriment for that, lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. The nutriment for that is careless attention. Nutriment for that, lack of faith or lack of confidence. And the nutriment for that, not hearing the good Dhamma, the Sadhamma. In other words, essentially the Dhamma that the Buddha awakened to, right? That particular insight. And the nutriment for not hearing the good Dhamma is not associating with good persons. So this is interesting, this idea of nutriment, how you build up one state and then leading on to the next one, stage by stage, right? And not associating with the right people, the good people, those who see things according to reality. That is why ignorance or delusion or lack of seeing things for what they actually are, how that is built up over time, gets worse and worse. And of course, the reverse is true. That's what we'll see in a minute. That the reverse, of course, is also the case. Then, if you hang out with the, if you associate with the good people, the superior people, sapurisa is the Pali word, and sapurisa basically means the Aryans, those who have a real insight into these teachings. So if you hang out with those, if you associate with them, then this thing leads on stage by stage all the way to awakening itself. Right? It's a beautiful message. All you really have to do is to hang out with those good people, listen to the Dhamma, reflect on that Dhamma. What does it actually mean? And as you do that, you're actually building up those causes and conditions that lead you all the way to awakening. It's such a nice little thing. You can see there what is going on. There's no sense of striving, right? No sense that you have to force yourself, use a lot of willpower. All you have to do is establish those first conditions really well. And as they get established well, then everything else almost takes care of itself by itself. It just happens. There's nothing more you have to do. It's kind of easy, right? Just read the suttas. Just hang out with the right people. Hang out with Ajahn Brahm, right? Read the suttas. Reading suttas like hanging out with the Buddha. And then you hang out with Ajahn Brahm. And you hang out with other good people, your mates in the holy life. And then, it just goes by itself. So this is, I think, a very important message, because it reminds you of what is the root cause for this whole process to happen by itself. This happens like that if you put in the basic things here. Now, one of the interesting points here, of course, is that ignorance itself, the idea here of avidya, is of course the root of dependent origination. Right? Dependent origination starts off with avidya, ignorance and delusion, and that, through the 12 links of paticca-samuppada, leads to suffering at the end, or to death and suffering, etc. So what we are doing here, in a sense, by this, what this series is doing, it's coming in at the very bottom of dependent origination, and it undermines that very first link of dependent arising. It actually shows you how to root out avijja, the very first thing. And then that, of course, then feeds through all the 12 links, and it then ends up by ending suffering itself. So this whole series here links in with dependent origination directly here, and then shows you how the ending of suffering happens as a consequence. Now, one of the nice things, if you look at this sequence, in a way you can, one way of looking at this sequence is to group some of these factors together. It gives you a bit more kind of perspective on what is going on. There's so many factors here, you almost lose track of what is going on. But you can start off with the 5 hindrances and the 3 kinds of misconduct, right? So that is about the impurity of the mind, right? It comes back to the mind always. So that's about the impurity of the mind. And then you have the factors which are non-restraint of the sense faculties, lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension, careless attention, right? So these things are really a lot about how to reflect, how to look at the world, how to think about things in the right way. Especially careless attention is about thinking about things in the wrong way. Very closely related also to a lack of clear comprehension. So when you think about things in the wrong way, when you look at the world in the wrong way, when you perceive things in the wrong way, that leads to the impurity of the mind. Right? And then the very first parts here, which are a lack of faith, a lack of not hearing the good Dhamma, and not associating with the right people. That is all about about understanding the suttas, basically. Seeing the suttas in action by hanging around the right people, hearing the suttas, and then gaining a sense of confidence as a consequence. So what you can see here, what's going on, is that it starts off by associating with the right people, the Aryas. And from that, you start reflecting in the right way. Right reflection, right contemplation, right way of thinking arises as a consequence of just being with the Aryans, the noble people. And then because you are thinking in the right way, that then in turn leads to the purity of the mind. So you purify the mind. Right? Read the suttas. When you read the suttas, you get brainwashed. It's good, right? It's good. Is that right? Good or bad? Getting brainwashed. I think it's good, actually. It's good to get brainwashed. If you get brainwashed in the right way, it's great. Get brainwashed in the wrong way, it's bad. So you get brainwashed, which basically means here that you are reflecting in a different way. You're thinking in a different way from what you're used to. And because you're thinking in a different way, then that leads to the purity of the mind as a consequence. And this is one of those, I think, important points of the Dhamma, is that how your purity of your actions, your speech, and also the way you think, it is based on not so much how you strive or what you do, etc. It is based on your ability to reflect in the right way. If you think in the right way, then good conduct comes as a consequence of that, including your mental good conduct. If you reflect in the wrong way, the bad conduct comes from that. There's a small sutta about that in the Anguttara Nikaya. Talks about 2 different powers. And one of the powers it talks about is the patisankhana, balla. Balla is power. Patisankhana is like reflection. So the power of reflection. And what is the purpose of the power of reflection? It's good conduct. Right? So good conduct arises from reflecting in the right way here. And so this is, I think, it's a very important point. All we need to do to purify our mind, or at least to a very high level, and also speech and body, whatever, is to think in the right way. And when you think in the right way, then it happens as a consequence. And and how do you learn to think in the right way? By understanding the Dhamma, how these things work. So that shows you kind of how the path works in a slightly more bird's eye view, because there are so many factors here that otherwise you might get a bit lost if you see all of those factors kind of lumped together there. So then let's move on to the next paragraph then. So that was just a brief review of the first main paragraph there, and we'll have a look at this thing in reverse order in a second. If you have any questions, please ask questions as we go along if you like. Then it says, thus not associating with good persons, the Sapurisa, becoming full, fills up not hearing the good Dhamma. Not hearing the good Dhamma, becoming full, fills up lack of faith or confidence. Lack of faith, becoming full, fills up careless attention. Careless attention, becoming full, fills up lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. Lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension, becoming full, fills up non-restraint of the sense faculties. Non-restraint of the sense faculties, becoming full, fills up the three kinds of misconduct. The three kinds of misconduct, becoming full, fill up the five hindrances. The five hindrances, becoming full, fill up avidya, ignorance, delusion, not seeing things according to reality. Thus there is a nutriment for ignorance, and in this way it becomes full. So it's kind of scary, isn't it? You see the three kinds of misconduct becoming full. The more misconduct you do, the more hindrances there are, and the more deluded, the more stupid, and the more silly, the less you see things according to reality. So how these things are kind of tied together so strongly there. It's kind of a sobering thought. And also very interesting, of course, the fact that just by being virtuous, just by living in a good way, that is already diminishing the hindrances as a consequence. And then delusion is decreasing. Every time you do a good act, every time you avoid doing something bad, you are becoming less deluded. Isn't that kind of a great additional way of looking at the idea of kindness? Usually we think of kindness, making good karma, being harmonious, but actually it also decreases delusion. You get more clarity here. You understand things more according to reality here. Oh, that's pretty powerful thing for the good old morality there and ethics, just that much. I think that's where we got up to last time. So this is where we're going to continue on from here. Is that right? Is that where we were last time? I can't remember anymore. It's a month ago since we did this. But so now we come to this beautiful simile, which kind of makes the point here how this works in the as far as the similes are concerned. And this, I think, is one of the great things about the Buddha, his ability to come up with these similes that are so powerful, so memorable, and kind of illustrate the point so incredibly well. And this is one of the things that make the suttas come alive to me. And actually, sometimes when you read something theoretical, it's kind of a bit dry. But then you see the simile and it kind of drives it home, and you know what's going on. So this is what he has to say. Just as when it is raining and the rain pours down in thick droplets on a mountaintop, the water flows down along the slope and fills the clefts, the gullies and the creeks. These becoming full fill up the pools. These becoming full fill up the lakes. These becoming full fill up the streams. These becoming full fill up the rivers. And these becoming full fill up the great ocean. Thus there is nutriment for the great ocean, and in this way it becomes full. So too, not associating with the good persons, etc., etc., fills up ignorance, fills up delusion, fills up avidya at the very end there. So this great thing, right? If you just keep on raining on that mountaintop, keep the water coming, keep on reading the suttas, keep on listening to the right kind of Dhamma talks, keep on hanging out with the Sapurisa. Sapurisa means like is elsewhere translated as a superior person, right? This is kind of the idea of superiority in Buddhism, is the idea of how much insight you have. If you keep on doing that, keep on raining and raining and raining and raining, you do it again and again and again, you can't avoid that this fills up the little creeks, and then that gradually fills up and fills up and takes you all the way to the ocean, which here is the simile for Nibbana or liberation, or the ending of the defilements and the ending of suffering, of course. Right? So that's all you have to do. Keep on raining at the very top, and the rain here, again, is just basically getting that inspiration, that understanding that the suttas give you, allowing yourself to be gradually brainwashed, right? People think, oh, brainwashing is really scary, I don't want to be brainwashed. I want to be independent, right? I want to make my own decisions. I don't want to be brainwashed. It's a bit like when When I became a Buddhist monk, I think my parents were a bit worried. Oh, I might get brainwashed by this terrible Buddhist religion. What's going to happen to you when you go there to, you know, and you get brainwashed? But the point is, and I think this is kind of the thing, that the issue here is that you have to get brainwashed. There's no choice. And this is the whole idea of non-self, the implication of non-self, is that there is brainwashing regardless. Either you get brainwashed by bad stuff in the world, or you get brainwashed by something good. So you have to choose the good brainwashing, right? So when you choose the good brainwashing, you're fine. If you choose the bad one, you're in trouble. So make sure, the message here is choose the right kind of brainwashing. Get the right soul powder, right, or whatever it is, and come out the other end. What comes out the other end? You come out awakened, hooray, at the other end. That's the real brainwashing for you. So brainwashing is basically just a function that of the fact that there is no self. Everything, we are all... Basically, we are the sum total of the conditions and circumstances that work on us. So it's a matter of choosing the right brainwashing. And as you allow that brainwashing to work on you, and what is good brainwashing? Well, if it makes you happier, if it takes you where you want to go, right? That's good brainwashing here. So that is that beautiful simile. And it's fascinating how everything just starts by, you know, being with the right kind of people, and it takes you from there. So that is the kind of the negative sequence, seeing how delusion kind of builds up. And now we're going to have to look at the positive sequence. And this is how this works. And I'll read out the whole thing, and then I will discuss the various points in a bit more detail afterwards. I say, because that true knowledge and liberation have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment for true knowledge and liberation? It should be said the seven factors of awakening. And the seven factors of awakening too, I say, have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment for the seven factors of awakening? It should be said the four focuses of mindfulness. The four focuses of mindfulness too, I say, have a nutriment. And what is that? The three kinds of good conduct. And the three kinds of good conduct too, I say, have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And that is the restraint of the sense faculties. And the restraint of the sense faculties too, I say, have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And what is that? Mindfulness and clear comprehension. And that too has a nutriment. And what is that? It's careful attention. Yoniso manasikara. And careful attention too has a nutriment, and that is faith or confidence. And faith and confidence too has a nutriment. Hearing the good Dhamma, the Sat Dhamma. And hearing the good Dhamma too, I say, has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is that nutriment? It is associating with the good people, the Sapurisa, which is the nutriment for that. So here, again, you can see the forward sequence, how it all begins with associating with the right kind of people, and it ends up with true knowledge and liberation at the very top there. So liberation, of course, meaning, as always, liberation from suffering, liberation from all these oppressions in life, the defilements, and all this kind of stuff. And the true knowledge, which is the seeing things according to reality, understanding things in the right way, which includes things like rebirth and karma and non-self, and all of that stuff is part of that dependent arising. Yeah. And of course, liberation and true knowledge, of course, go together. If you understand things according to reality, that is precisely when there is no more suffering here. Which is good news. So seeing things is always a good idea from Buddhist point of view. So what is it that leads to this liberation? And it says here the seven factors of awakening. Right? So I don't know if you remember the seven factors of awakening, what they are about. But essentially the seven factors of awakening, when you look at them, they are basically about samadhi practice. I will have maybe a quick look at them in detail just in a second, but they're all about samadhi practice. And so what you are seeing here is the thing that you see throughout the suttas. And it's one of those extraordinarily important points that you cannot really make too much of, I think. And that is the fact that samadhi, samadhi, right? That is the cause for seeing things according to reality. That is the cause for vidya here, for true knowledge, as they say here. And this is something you see not just in this sutta. This sutta just kind of reinforces that message. But it's one of those fundamental things that you see on the, what is in the sequence called dependent liberation, right? Dependent liberation, you have the, all the happiness is on the path. The pamuja leads to piti, which is rapture, which leads to pasadi, tranquility, leads to sukha, happiness, which leads to samadhi, right? Samadhi, what does that lead to? Yata bhuta jnanadasana, seeing things according to reality here. And this is one of those things that you see throughout the suttas. It's everywhere. It's absolutely, you know, it's so fundamental to the way this path works. And it's exactly the same thing you see here, right here in the sutta. To be able to reach that final awakening, samadhi is a crucial factor that you need to get there. So, I think this is a very important message, because sometimes this is forgotten about, that this is actually so fundamental in the suttas. So what are these factors, seven factors of awakening here? And what they are, you know, the start off with the awakening factor of mindfulness, right? And what we will see in a second here, we're just reading out, is that the four satipatthanas, the four right mindfulnesses, they are the cause or the nutriment for the seven factors of awakening here. Right? So they are the cause. That is why the seven factors of awakening start with sati. The sati sambojanga, the factor of awakening, which is mindfulness. Because it meshes in with the four satipatthanas. That is the first one. And the second one is the dhammavicaya sambojanga. Dhammavicaya means like investigation of the dhamma or dhammas. Right? Investigation of dhamma, factor of awakening. What does that mean? And what it means is that you understand basically the defilements of the mind. You understand the dark and the bright states. You understand what is blameworthy and what is not. That's basically what it is. In other words, you understand those things that are defiling. You understand the impurities of the mind, and you understand the alternative, which are the pure factors of the mind, purity and impurity. Yeah. So that is the dhammavicaya sambojanga, understanding the mind down to its kind of last details of purity and impurity. And that is almost the same thing that you find in satipatthana again. Yeah. When you look at satipatthana, the last one is the dhamma nupassana, investigation or the contemplation of dhammas, right? Dhammas here meaning kind of mental factors or mental states, or even perhaps causality itself. And what that is all about is understanding the five hindrances, how they arise, how they are abandoned, what sustains that abandoning in the future, how they come to be completely abandoned. Right? It's about causality and understanding how these things actually arise in the first place. Why is it that desire arises? Why does ill will arise? And the Buddha gives the answer to these things as well in the suttas. But, you know, you can see this. When you see this in your own mind, it becomes very powerful. So this is what dhammavicaya, and again, it meshes in with the four foundations of mindfulness. You can see that two different frameworks for looking at exactly the same thing. And then the four foundations, or not the foundations, I don't like that, four focuses of mindfulness, or maybe the four establishings of mindfulness. The next thing they talk about is the seven factors of awakening, right? You can see how close this is related to each other here. So that, then they talk about what are the causes for these seven factors of awakening to arise. How do these things come into existence? So you can see they're almost kind of overlapping with each other in a strange way here. So that is the second factor of awakening, the dhammavicaya sambojanga, the factor of awakening, which is the investigation of states or dhammas or qualities in your mind, and then that leads to energy. Is that right? I hope I have this right now. That would be embarrassing sitting here saying all the wrong things. Ooh, I think that is right. Energy comes after that, right? So the third one is the energy. That's the virya sambojanga. And what is happening here is that when you understand the defilements of the mind, that is when you can abandon them. And as you abandon those defilements, the natural energy of the mind arises to the surface. The mind is always energetic. The thing that stops the mind from being energetic, the reason you feel tired in the morning, right, or the reason you feel tired after work or tired at any time, is because there are defilements there, and they actually dampen the mind down. The less defilements you have, the more energy you have. So as you do the Dhamma Vichaya, as you do the investigation of Dhammas, it all dies down, and the energy, the natural energy of the mind arises. When the Buddha talks about virya, he talks about energy. He doesn't mean applying yourself. He doesn't mean willpower. He doesn't mean forcing yourself. He means the natural energy that is there. This is the best thing, right? When it's natural energy, because it means that it is actually very natural and forceless. Yes, Chris? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Centered energy. Because already at this point, you're becoming quite focused, right? If you're meditating, for example, you'll already be staying quite closely with your meditation object, even. So this would be definitely kind of focused kind of energy. It can be a little bit scattered, not completely focused, perhaps, but not the kind of restless energy that you have when the mind is scattered, that sort of stuff. Yeah, it's a beautiful energy because it's a natural energy of the mind. It's just there. You don't have to put in any effort, any force, right? It's just great. It's kind of this easeful energy here. And it's really, So that is energy. And from that comes then the piti. The piti being the rapture, the gladness, the happiness, right, in the mind, which comes in, can come in many different strengths and many different qualities, which comes with energy and mindfulness. And rapture or gladness, joy, these things are very closely related to each other. If you are mindful, if you're really mindful, you tend to be energetic and joyful at the same time. If you have the right kind of energy, it comes with mindfulness and joy at the same time. These things are very closely related to each other. And they arise together. And they arise, why do they arise? They arise as a function of the declining of the defilements. The less defilements you have, the more all of these things come together. It's all about getting rid of these defilements and impurities. And this just happens all by itself. So that is always the problem, is these impurities. And this is useful to know, right? Because what that means is that the path of practice, this is why the Buddhist path of practice is often called the Visuddhi Magga, the path of purity. Path of purity, because it is a gradual purification, and it leads to purity at the end of the day. Right? That's why it's called the path of Buddhism can be called that, the Visuddhi Magga. It doesn't refer to that big work by Buddha Gosa called the Visuddhi Magga. It refers to just the natural, how the Eightfold Path works by itself. It purifies you. And as you get purified in this way, these things happen. So what that means is that any kind of exercise we do, right? Sometimes people talk about sammata, vipassana, and they kind of divide, this is sammata, this is vipassana. I don't think that's really possible to divide things in that way. The Buddha doesn't talk about sammata practice and vipassana practice. These are just aspects, different aspects of basically the same practice. What matters is that we're doing those things that overcome the defilements. If you are doing something called vipassana practice and it overcomes the defilements, great. If you're doing something called sammata practice and it overcomes the defilements, great. If you're doing neither, it's not called neither of those, and you're overcoming defilements, wonderful. If it's both, wonderful. This is the Buddhist way or logic, right? You have one or the other, both or neither. So just kind of to apply that in this situation as well. So this is what matters. So ask yourself, is what you're doing, is it doing the job of overcoming those defilements gradually, stage by stage, over time, looking over long periods of time, weeks, months, years? If it is, then you know you're doing the right thing here. So it is very important to take a kind of charge of your own spiritual practice, and not just follow along kind of with brute force or just blindly, but looking at yourself, does it actually work? And then from that piti, now this is where meditation is really starting to work, right, becoming very powerful. From the piti comes the pasadi, which is the tranquility, where you are becoming very, very peaceful. You just want to sit there forever and ever and ever. And then from the pasadi comes the Samadhi Sambhujanga, right? Samadhi. And of course, in Buddhism, when we talk about Samadhi, there is one Samadhi which is talked about more than any other Samadhi in the suttas. And that, of course, is the four jhanas. This is what you see everywhere. So when you talk about Samadhi without any further kind of definition, you can take it that it refers more than anything else to the four jhanas. And then that Samadhi then leads to the Upekkha Sambhujanga, the evenness of mind, right? Often translated as equanimity here. The factor of awakening, which is equanimity or evenness of mind. Or sometimes just looking on without reaction. That's another meaning of the word Upekkha. Huh? So you stand back, you just watch without reacting here. And so this is the last one. And that, of course, refers to the very high stages of samadhi. When you get to samadhi, like the fourth jhana or whatever, that's when you're talking about these things. So the seven factors of awakening are about the process of getting into samadhi, all the factors that are required, and they're also about the samadhi itself to the very highest level. So this is what they're all about. And the sequence I mentioned before that I call dependent liberation, which starts off with virtue and then goes through very similar kind of steps, is essentially the same thing but looked upon from a different angle. Right? Seven factors of awakening, same thing as dependent liberation. So we different ways of looking at the same process. So that is what then leads you to, once you are established in that samadhi, that's when you can actually get to the get the full awakening, right? The knowledge, true knowledge and liberation come as a consequence. And then we have, yeah, please. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you, sir, please. If in spite of doing the meditational practices, vipassana or mindfulness activities, if the defilement keeps on coming repeatedly, is it that there is something wrong with the technique that is being adopted, or one has, it's because of the kamma or anything else?
Okay. Usually, if they keep, the farmers keep coming back, you have to ask yourself, is there something on the Eightfold Path you haven't done properly here? Is there an aspect of the path you're not practicing, right? And very often, remember, one of the main reasons here is not the meditation so much that keeps the defilements down. It's more how you think in daily life, right? So by thinking in the right way in ordinary life, that is actually, that reflection is what keeps these defilements down. And then the meditation functions as a process. Meditation itself, it can help in reducing the defilements. But it's not enough. This is not, there are things that are more basic than that you need to establish first of all. And that is just your right conduct, your right way of speaking to people, the right way of thinking about people. This is the most important thing. And only when you get that integrity of the Noble Eightfold Path, all the factors coming together, that's when it starts to work. So you have to ask yourself, am I thinking in the right way here? Why am I getting upset with these people, right? You're getting upset with somebody. Why is that? But the reality is there's no reason really to get upset with anybody here. So the reason you get upset with them is because you're looking at them in the wrong way here. Right? So how do you look at other people? Well, it's very simple. You remember that they are acting that way because of causes and conditions, because of their own conditioning, because of their own circumstances in the past, maybe even past lives, right? That's why they're acting like that. It's not personal. It's not about you. It's about them. Right? And even this, if they wanted to act more in a more wholesome way, they probably can't because they are conditioned so strongly here. So you start to look at people in this way, using some of these, basic Buddhist ideas. And when you do that, your whole way of looking and relating to other people changes. And that's where where things change. So that is what you have to do, and then your meditation will support that aspect of virtue, if you like. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
I stick around for about 2.5 years.
Yeah.
And they really get deepening into the practice. And
are and release a much deeper level of kalesha into the system. And that's a time when a lot of people bolt from this place because they're actually their sense of identity of the, you know, basically they start to disintegrate, and that's part of the spiritual path. Those deeper levels of disturbance, kalashas, impurities start to come up, and my experience of them is, you know, they're precipitated by deep and peaceful meditation. Shortly after I have, or if I have periods of deep and peaceful meditation, then shortly after that, oftentimes all hell breaks loose. But I'm okay about that because I've got a bit of steadiness. But it's not all a bowl of cherries. You know, it goes backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
What would you say about that?
I think the thing is that it depends why people come here. People come here for all kind of reasons, right? They come here to sort out the kind of problems in life, the superficial things that are going on. But if you, or you come for a kind of deeper purpose, actually, because you see a bigger picture of what's happening here. And if you come here to sort out the basic things, and you come to that point, and you're kind of satisfied with that, you get a bit of peace in your meditation or whatever, and you're satisfied with that, that's great. You know, if you want to leave then, that's okay. And you you already obviously gotten something out of the Buddhist practice. But if you are more committed to this practice, then you have to ask yourself what's going on. Okay, it is maybe difficult, it's scary, perhaps even or it's disintegrating. I mean, I think if you are feeling like you're disintegrating, probably you have some kind of mental underlying stuff going on already, right? There's something going on there. So perhaps then you might even want to see a psychologist to help you out through some of that stuff. The reality is that, you know, if I guess they have to look at their mind and see, well, you know, now I'm feeling a little bit more peaceful, there is obviously some positive aspects with that, and those positive things, if I can develop those further, would be great. So let me see if I can find a way through this. There must be a reason why these problems are there. What is going on? And always, if you look, if you're willing to investigate, you will find out the causes for what's going on, and it will take you further. So the sense that you are disintegrating personally just means you are psychologically perhaps a bit unstable. Perhaps you need to go back to the basic aspects of the Buddhist path. The more you kind of, the stronger foundation you have in the basics, the more stable you will be psychologically as well.
Yeah, that's probably just a word that I use for myself, because I do, it feels like that I'm disintegrating, but I'm okay about that. I'm okay about sort of falling apart. But, this idea of disturbance, deeper level of disturbance, that it seems to me, if you have a look at all established practitioners in lots of different traditions, if they've been hanging in for quite some time, they'll go through these. Or even the Christians call it the dark night of the soul. That's sort of deep stuff, where you really are challenged in your worldview and who and what you are and what you're on about.
Sure.
And that's oftentimes preceded by stillness. That's preceded by stillness and just, you know, isn't it beautiful and blissful and all that sort of stuff. And then, bang, this stuff comes up.
Yeah, I think it's not just about the stillness itself. It's also about how you use that stillness afterwards, right? And it's how you actually reflect on it and how you use it. I think that's part of the problem as well. So very often, you know, you start off the process by enjoying the meditation practice. Don't worry too much about what it actually means or what kind of its effects are. Just enjoy the practice. And this is, I think, one of the reasons precisely why, you know, the Buddha talks about these very profound states of samadhi, because that gives you the strength of the mind and the ability to deal with the kind of insights that may come up later on, because you are basically like rock solid at that particular stage. So I think this is one of the dangers sometimes if you start to use some of these vipassana techniques and you're not ready for it. I've heard of many cases of people going slightly psychotic because of this vipassana. You're looking at all this stuff happening, but your mind doesn't have the stability yet, and then you flip out and you go overboard and you end up in hospital, and you stay in hospital for weeks afterwards. And some people are traumatized for years afterwards because of these things. And that's terrible, because it's exactly the opposite of what we're trying to do. You build up all the good qualities. You feel more centered, more at ease with yourself, more complete, right? And instead of feeling disintegrated, you feel actually the opposite. You feel integrated as a person. And the more integrated you feel and the more strength of mind you have in that case, the easier it is to deal with those weird stuff and the insights that come afterwards. It's all about doing things in the right order and knowing what you have to do with yourself. But very often, just get the basics right, right? This is so important. I think this is where, you know, really focus on the ability to look at other people in the right way. Be kind to other people. Say the right thing. Remember, every time you open your mouth, it's an opportunity to do something kind, right? To be compassionate, to do something good for others. If you take every opportunity you have, every time you open your mouth, wow, so many opportunities to do good, right? And after a while, you start to feel that. You start to feel good about yourself because you take every opportunity here. So, and this is really the foundation aspect. These are the most important things, I think, of all, and often and neglected. And that is one of the reasons why you get these kind of results. So. John. Well, I mean, the word samadhi in the suttas is used a bit more broadly than just the four jhanas. It has also some other usages as well. But generally, if it is used in a way which is not specified, then normally it would be referenced to the four jhanas, as I see the suttas. Because the four jhanas are by far the most common, you know, samadhi that is mentioned there. Yeah. Okay, Eddie. Yeah. Yeah, you mean like sense restraint, basically. Yeah. Less contact. Sure. That's true. I think that's a valid point of view, using dependent origination to look at these things. I would say maybe not so much dependent origination, but just the idea that you know, experiences arise through the senses, and that's when defilements often arise in that conjunction. But remember, the point is, the most important point is how we deal with that senses when they, you know, when you have an experience, how do you deal with that? That's the most important thing here. And often you can't just shut it out, so you learn to look at the experience in a different way here. Yeah, and then you can overcome these things. Okay. Yes? Yeah? Yeah.
And in doing that, now I forgot what I was going to say. But in doing that, quite often a person needs guidance and support to help them understand what's happening to them.
Yeah.
And maybe in Buddhism, there isn't that much of that about. I haven't seen much of that about.
Much guidance, you mean? Huh?
In allowing that person to have perhaps sessions where they can be with either psychologists or in a group form or something where they can release it out
Okay.
and allow the other understanding to come in through the guidance of they've understood what's happening.
Yeah.
And again, it's just ongoing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, when, you know, the main psychologist in Buddhism is the Buddha, right? He's the number one psychologist. So part of it you can actually get by reading the word of the Buddha. This is part of the thing here. You start
sometimes
to understand.
Sometimes understanding what the defilement really is and where it actually came from. You need a one-on-one or something, a person who has the empathy or the training or whatever to be able to support that person in going through that process.
I guess sometimes that's necessary. I guess it depends on the strength of the defilements and what is going on and your ability to understand or not. And if you need that, then often you have to go to a psychologist, right, or something like that to talk with them. That's often probably the best thing to do. But I think there comes a point when you're able to take charge of a lot of this practice yourself and you know what's going on. Because the basic things are the same for everybody, right? Something negative happens and you get upset about it, or the opposite is something nice happens and you desire these things. These are kind of the main, kind of the root kind of things that is going on in the mind. And of course, an important aspect there is also the confusion and delusion and not understanding what is happening here. But so once you kind of get up to a certain threshold, you can start to really understand your own practice and look after yourself to a large extent. But more basic than that, you probably have, as you say, go to a psychologist or something to do sort it out. Wayne?
The performance themselves, surely.
Yeah.
So Lord Buddha gave us the arrogance.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, ideally that's true, huh? But the thing is, I think sometimes people are they can't see, right? They don't know what's going on. They can't even see that they should come to Buddhism sometimes, right? for that reason, it can be very hard. Okay, well, let's Nicholas, okay. Yeah?
A lot of mental health issues based on people have very negative relationships to their own process. They think they're not good enough or lovable enough or not this or that enough. And I think if you just start off with the basic gradual path of kindness and generosity, eventually there's that transformation and you come to a point where you realise you are good enough and you are worthy enough and your mental health improves hugely. And I think sometimes if people are struggling, then maybe just start at the basics of a bit of generosity and care and support to others. And it's a natural unfolding where you just get more clarity and freedom from mental suffering.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's very true. And I think a lot of people, they do meditation practice, and I think meditation is kind of what Buddhism is all about. But I would say that what Buddhism is more about than meditation is actually sila. It's about your conduct. That's actually much more fundamental than meditation practice. So even if you just become more kind, right, more generous, as you say, more kind-hearted, speak more kindly, act more kindly, and then even start thinking more kindly. If you do that, that is actually much more important than the meditation practice. Yeah. Okay, I think we need to move on a little bit, because otherwise this is going to be a very, very long session. So basically, we were just having a look at the enlightenment factors and then saying that the four focuses of mindfulness, they are the cause for that. Right, and why is that? And the reason for that is because if you use those establishings of mindfulness, I mean, we're talking about very high things here, right? This is not basic Buddhism. This is already very high Buddhism already. We're here talking about the very deep stages of meditation and getting very close to awakening already at this stage. So that's why we're going to bring it back, but I think it's nice to kind of see the whole map. And when you see the whole map, you have some idea what's happening here. You understand the process, so to speak. So the idea here is that the four establishings of mindfulness, they are really about the overcoming of the defilements, right? We're just talking about that before, about how you do the Dhamma Vicaya, the investigation of the qualities of the mind, and how, etc., to understand how the mind works. And that is what these foundations of mindfulness really are about. And that's why they take you to samadhi, right? You see it here again, how satipatthana leads to samadhi. It leads to the bhujangas, which are all about samadhi, as I said before. Satipatthana leads to samadhi, one of those other very important themes in the Buddhist teachings. Which is interesting. Very often you hear satipatthana is vipassana. Well, satipatthana is just satipatthana. But where it goes to samadhi. Huh? So, and what one way of looking at this, to see that, see how this works, is to just compare it to the sequence on the other side of the page that we looked at before, where in place of the satipatthana and the bhujanga, you have the five hindrances, right? So the satipatthanas are the opposite of the five hindrances. They're the opposite of the bhujangas. Yeah, so the hindrances, well, I think I got that the wrong way around. The hindrances are the opposite of satipatthana and the opposite of the bhujangas. So this shows you the purpose of these factors when you get to this point, abandoning all that negative states of mind and moving on to the positive things. But again, we are dealing with very refined things here, more refined than the majority of people do during their meditation at any other time. But anyone, the point of course is that anyone has the potential to get there, right? So if you're not there yet, it's only a matter of time if you get these things right, if you keep on investigating and you do those things that actually work. Yeah. So now what is the nutriment for the four focuses of mindfulness? This is again a very important thing, because when we get to the focuses of mindfulness, we are essentially getting to meditation practice. The four focuses of mindfulness, the most important way that these are practiced is through the anapanasati, the breath meditation. So here we are starting on meditation practice. So what this is telling us now is what is the necessary condition for meditation practice to work. And what it tells you is that you need the three kinds of good conduct. Right, and this is so important. This is again one of those things that you see throughout the suttas, that mindfulness, for it to really be powerful, for satipatthana to work, the only way it's really going to work is if you have the three kinds of good conduct in place first of all. Right, and this is quite demanding. We're talking here about right action, we're talking about right speech, we're talking also about right mental attitude to a very large extent. And only when this is in place is actually meditation possible. And this is why I think, Chris, that many of these people have problems, right? Because they haven't established the foundations yet for the mindfulness to be strong enough to actually work. And suddenly things flood your mind, defilements or whatever, and you feel really confused. This, I think it's well known, these are, that a lot of people actually that try to do mindfulness and they find it terrible. They find it absolutely scary because they see all these things they don't want to see here. And that is because your mindfulness has been taken out of context. This is what you often find in secular Buddhism and things, taken out of context, used in a completely, without any kind of this kind of framework at all. And of course, you're throwing people in the deep end. And if your mind is already unstable, if you haven't kind of got a positive sense of self or whatever, it's going to be very, very challenging. Yeah. So that's why I think all of this needs to be shown in context, understood as a complete integrated package deal. It's not a kind of individual factors that work. Yeah. So very important that sila, in a very deep sense, has to be established before satipatthana is possible. And of course, part of this is mental sila. So part of this means that you don't really get all that, you don't get angry all that much, right? You don't have very powerful cravings anymore. All that has already died down to some extent. Then meditation becomes really possible. So that is the three kinds of good conduct. I'm not going to go into more detail on those now. And then we move on to sense restraint. I did talk about all of these things last time a lot. So if you haven't heard last time's, the last talk, maybe you can probably get that on the internet now, I'm sure. So sense restraint, again, is necessary because if your sense faculties are always out there, always kind of in the world and very easily latch onto objects in the world, then of course very easily aversion and desires are going to arise. So some degree of mindfulness that makes your mind more even, right? This is necessary for that virtue to be possible. So sense restraint is a prerequisite for the three kinds of good conduct. And then we have the mindfulness and clear comprehension, which is largely emphasis on clear comprehension, which is the idea, again, that you know, you do those things in life that you know lead you in the right way on the path. You have a sense of purpose in your life, a sense of what is important, what actually matters. And then you arrange, so to speak, the rest of your life almost around those things that are important. You don't do those things that lead to problems, and you do those things that encourage you on the path. Clear comprehension is described as, clear comprehension has four aspects, but the two most important ones are suitability and purpose. So is it fulfilling the purpose, right, of your life? Is it suitable for that purpose? Suitability, purpose, very closely related to each other. And when you get that right, then you are kind of starting to align everything in your life with the Noble Eightfold Path. Right? This is very, again, this is quite, it's high, right? It's almost like becoming a monastic, because that's obviously when you really start to, well, hopefully anyway, that's the idea, to start aligning everything according to the Dhamma. But if you have a clear sense of what actually matters, right, what is important in life, where is real happiness to be found, where is the end of suffering to be found, the more clarity you have about that, the better understanding you have of these teachings, the more brainwashed you are, right? The more brainwashed you are, you start to align these things in accordance with that brainwashing, and you start to make your life, create a life which is in accordance with that. This is an important part of sampajanya. If you always put yourself in the wrong position, it's impossible to have sense restraint, because you're always kind of influenced by all these things around you. And then we have this beautiful thing, which is the cause or the nutriment of clear comprehension and mindfulness, which is careful attention. Yoniso manasikara. Right? Yoniso manasikara, which is one of these foundational things on the Buddhist path, which is always powerful, always useful. The moment you kind of get started on the Buddhist path, the moment you start out, you say, yeah, I want to practice meditation. You come to the center for the first time, really confused and really scared of the monastics, right? That's what I was like when I started. I remember, monastics are really scary places. But gradually, you kind of chill a little bit, and things are kind of easier. And so that is the first Yoniso Manasikara. You know actually that you're going to a place which is going to be useful to you. And then you freak out a little bit, as Chris was saying sometimes, but then you kind of come back again and you gradually move forward. Every time you do something which leads you in the right direction, is called Yoniso Manasikara. Every time you have a thought which is in accordance with the path, it's Yoniso Manasikara. When somebody treats you badly and you forgive them straight away because you know that it's just their conditioning, it's Yoniso Manasikara. Right? Every time somebody does something bad to you and you get upset, that's Yoniso Manasikara. Careless attention, wrong attention. So this is very easily defined, Yoniso Manasikara, defined as it is Yoniso Manasikara if that whatever attention you have at that time aligns with the path and brings you to a better state afterwards rather than a worse state. If it brings you to a worse state, it's Yoniso Manasikara. It's all about reflection, right? It's all about how we think about the world, how we think about everything. It's very good. Yes? Daydreaming, yeah. You daydream about something positive, right? You daydream about meditating. Oh, meditation! Wow, so nice. And this is one of those things that if you really want to have a daydream, then if you understand what is important in life, you daydream about those things, right? You think about, when can I get back to my cushion? Whoa, I really want to get back to my cushion and meditate. That is the ideal. But I think that, you know, daydreaming is really the opposite of kind of mindfulness. Mindfulness means being present here and now. Daydreaming means being all over the place, right? It's some fantasy world somewhere. So ideally, you want to avoid that. But don't use force. Understand that the reason why you are daydreaming is because you want to find some happiness somewhere, right? If you, right now, wow, it's so boring or it's so kind of painful to be here. I don't want to be here, so you daydream instead. And that is part of the problem. So, but by doing all the right things, eventually you are content to be here. And when you're content to be here, the daydreaming kind of stops by itself. So the ideal way is to make it stop by itself rather than force it out of the way here. And this is what this is all about. It shows you, this is why these suttas about causality are so important. Because when you understand causality, you understand the basic things that drive the whole process. Put in the basic things, everything else happens as a consequence. So you don't judge yourself for daydreaming. It's just part of being human. You know, everybody daydreams at least every now and again. Some people more than others. But so don't judge yourself, but ask yourself, well, why is this happening here? And what you will see is that you're not really happy where you are, not really content with where you are. Okay, so how do I make myself more content? And then you build up those basic factors that give rise to contentment. And those factors are basically very simple. They are just the factors of kindness. That's basically what it is. If you can, the more you can are able to act from kindness in your life all the time and avoid the bad things, you just start feeling good about yourself. And the present moment becomes very nice. You don't want to daydream anymore because it's nice to hang out here. Yeah? Okay. So that is Yoniso Manasikara, and this is something you take with you from the moment you step onto the path. All the way to the very end of the path always requires reflecting in the right way, careful attention, or wise attention. And what is the nutriment for Yoniso Manasikara? Very interesting. It is saddha, which is often translated as faith or confidence in Buddhism. And of course, that faith then refers to the faith in the Dhamma, in the teachings of the Buddha. So when you have confidence in that, then Yoniso Manasikara arises from that. Which is interesting because if we translate as wise attention, the wisdom that we have in the beginning, it comes from the Buddha. Right? That's where the wisdom comes from. It is not so much our inherent wisdom, but it's actually driven by the Buddha. There is something inherent because you have to recognize, of course, that the Buddha is saying something useful. But once you recognize that, the teachings you take on board, you're taking on this wisdom from the outside. Like, you know, the Buddha is called the eye of the world. The Buddha has seen, and now you accept that. You have faith that the Buddha has seen. So you take on board those teachings, and then you act accordingly. So initially, that Yoniso Manasikara is not really so much your own wisdom. It is the wisdom from the outside. And gradually, it becomes your own wisdom. Gradually, you start to see that this is indeed correct. And then it becomes much more easy to act in that way as a consequence. So faith, confidence, leads to Yoniso Manasikara, at least initially. And eventually, it becomes your own own faculty in your own mind. And what does faith arise? Hearing the good Dhamma, the Sad Dhamma, the true Dhamma, which is anything which teaches according to reality, any teaching which is according to reality. And of course, from our point of view, Buddhism would be certainly be that kind of teaching which is in accordance with reality. So when you hear that, then faith should arise, right? Ideally, if you think, oh, this is terrible stuff, I don't like this, then of course you're not going to get started. So you have to kind of enjoy the good Dhamma first of all, and then the faith comes as a consequence of that. And of course that good Dhamma comes from associating with those people who understand that Dhamma, right? Primarily that means the Buddha, hanging out with the Buddha. I like this idea of hanging out with the Buddha. People think it's kind of some kind of silly idea. Well, maybe they don't. I don't know what they think, but maybe they do. But it's not. You know, remember, these things were actually spoken to by the Buddha. They were spoken to people like us. They were spoken to ordinary people at that time. They were meant to be practiced. When you hear these suttas, you're actually in the presence of the Buddha. You're hearing his voice. Right? It's actually very powerful. And it is actually the Buddha talking to you when you hear these things. And it's very, very, very powerful to hang out with the Buddha in that sense. So when you read the suttas, don't, you know, be careful. Because again, this is the Buddha speaking. There's something very profound going on here. Take on board what you can. Try to understand what you can. And then allow it to sink in, to deepen over time. Remember that these are like true gems. These are there for your own good. These are there to help us to overcome suffering and move towards more happiness in the world. They're spoken out of pure compassion. There's nothing but compassion going into these things. So because that, when you read them, you can actually trust these teachings. There's something very powerful going on there. So listen to them. After you listen to them, reflect on them. What does this actually mean? Do I understand this properly? And as you reflect on them, they start to sink in and they start to become part of you. You come integrate it pretty much into your personality. Right? They're sitting there at the back of your mind, ready to be used at any moment's notice. Sometimes I like to talk about the idea of building up perceptions in your mind. And it's so important to have those perceptions ready sometimes. You may have perceptions about other people. There's some people that you really like and have these really good perceptions about them. And you put that perception on your perception shelf, right? And then when a negative perception about that person arises, you bring back that positive perception and you remind yourself of that. And in this way, you can have all these perceptions there, these ways of looking at the world, and you use the right perception at the right time to counteract anything negative that's happening in your mind. And this is dealing with your mind and perceptions according to these teachings, how the Buddha taught these things. So this way, you hang out with the Buddha. Of course, the Buddha is a little bit theoretical. He is, now he's just words on the page, and that kind of doesn't really drive home the point so much. So it's also good to have inspiring examples in our life. People who seem to be practicing the path in the right way, be doing the right thing. To see people like that too, I think is also important. When you get those two things together, the real life example, together with the teachings of the Buddha, then you have something very, very powerful to drive you forward on the path. And this is the basis, right? This is the foundation. This is the most basic thing for this whole sequence, taking you all the way to liberation. All you have to do, keep on reading those suttas, keep on listening to the right kind of Dhamma talks, hang out with the right people, do the right thing, and inexorably, naturally, you will incline in the right direction. This happens all by itself. And it's one of those wonderful things. I've been a Buddhist monk now for 21 years. Right? Doesn't seem long at all, actually. It maybe sounds long to you, but to me it seems like I became a monk yesterday, pretty much. But when I look over that period of time, I can see a change, an incredible change over those years. Something is actually happening. Sometimes I wonder why it is happening, because all I seem to do is hang around the monastery, read a few suttas, listening to Ajahn Brahm, but somehow that is working, and I'm changing. And you can see that process happening inside of yourself. And so this is what you have to do. If you keep on doing this, you will be seeing the same thing. You get more clarity here. You get less defilements. You get more sense of completeness, right? The craving dies down. More sense of completeness inside of yourself. More sense of satisfaction. All of these things are happening. Why are they happening? And mostly just because you are in the company of the right people, listening to the right teachings, reading the suttas, understanding what is going on, and then the whole process happens by itself. It's a bit like osmosis. That's what Ajahn Brahm says. You stay in the monastery, you get the Dhamma by osmosis. You just absorb it through your skin, right? It comes in. You don't know how it happens, but it happens somehow. And then this thing kind of takes off, happens like that. It's beautiful, right? It's so painless, and it's so easy. Of course, we have to apply ourselves as well, but these teachings, they make you want to apply yourself. When you start to understand the power of virtue, for example, right? You see, the Buddha says that Satipatthana is always based on this idea of sila. And remember, sila in Buddhism is avoid doing the bad, do the good, and also the mental aspect of sila. But the more you understand how powerful that is and how it supports everything else in the practice, you start to become very aware. You become very mindful of everything you do, because it's almost like you are a little bit worried. If I make a small bad step, it will take me backwards. It will be two steps back and one forward instead of two forward and one back. Right? Or even one step back kind of sets you back quite a bit. So you become very aware when you understand how important it is. You make an extra effort to not say the wrong thing, but to say the right thing. Every time you are around somebody, you use the opportunity to say something nice, right? Can I say something nice now? No? Okay, I don't have anything to say. I've got to shut up then. So you just be quiet. Either say something nice or don't say anything here. And in this way, it becomes very, you know, this is kind of how this drives you. Every time you want to do a small act, how can I do a small act of kindness? How can I avoid doing small acts of badness? This person, I find it really hard with this person. Actually, to be honest, I don't really like that person at all. I don't really want to say that because I want to be a good Buddhist, but actually, I don't really like them. So what can I do? How can I look at them differently? Build up some compassion. Understand that person is having problems just like you have. They also suffer. They are conditioned into the state they are. Of course you should have compassion for them, regardless of what they are like. Okay, so you find it difficult to be around them, so you don't not around them so much. That is fine. But at least have a sense of compassion for them. And when you start to understand the urgency of this, right? This is the foundation of everything. You put everything into that. That is what matters. And then when you go back, then when you sit down, you try to do your mindfulness of breathing, then it becomes powerful because you have put so much effort into the foundation stones. And it starts off just by hanging out with the Buddha, reading the suttas, and being with people who are practicing these teachings in the right way. So it's a beautiful sutta on, you know, the real foundation stones of this whole practice. So now let's have a look at the last couple of paragraphs. Thus, associating with good persons, becoming full, right, fills up hearing the good Dhamma. Hearing the good Dhamma becoming full fills up Saddha, faith and confidence. Faith and confidence becoming full fills up careful attention or wise attention. Wise attention becoming full fills up mindfulness and clear comprehension. Mindfulness and clear comprehension becoming full fill up the restraint of the sense faculties. Restraint of the sense faculties becoming full fill up the three kinds of good conduct. The three kinds of good conduct becoming full fill up the four focuses of mindfulness. The four focuses of mindfulness becoming full fill up the seven factors of awakening. The seven factors of awakening becoming full fill up true knowledge and liberation. Thus there is nutriment for true knowledge and liberation. And in this way they become full. Right? So gradually, gradually, gradually filling up each one. Making sure that you associate with good people as much as possible. It's interesting. Sometimes we think that we should associate with all kinds of people, right? Because we need to help others who are not kind of there on the path. And of course, sometimes that's true. Sometimes we do associate with people who are not, you know, superior people or good persons or whatever you want to call them. But the point here is that we have to be careful with that. We have to know our limitations, how much we can take, and we have to understand that the more we just hang out with the superior people, the more we get conditioned in the right way. So you fill it up, and then when you do that, you hear more of the good Dhamma, you see the example of the people, which is also an important part of hearing the message, and then you get brainwashed, right? And then this brainwashing, you get it's actually part of that is getting faith, right? You get faith in these teachings. And then from that brainwashing, you start having careful attention. And then you think in the right way. And this whole process just takes, starts, and it works its way through all the way to the end, to true knowledge and liberation as a consequence. Filling up stage by stage. But of course, you know, again, it takes a lot of filling up for the first one. Because each stage has to be filled up from the previous one, so it's like an exponential curve here. So it means that you have to really do a lot of work at the beginning to get to the last one. So it's not kind of it still takes a lot of effort to get there. And then again, the same simile again, just to drive home the point, right? Just as when it is raining and the rain pours down in thick droplets on the mountaintop. The water flows down along the slopes and fills the clefts, the gullies, and the creeks. These becoming full fill up the pools, these becoming full, fill up the lakes, these becoming full, fill up the streams, these becoming full, fill up the rivers, and these becoming full, fill up the great ocean. Thus there is nutriment for the great ocean, and in this way it becomes full. So too, associating with good persons, etc., fills up all the way to true knowledge and liberation. Thus there is nutriment for true knowledge and liberation, and in this way they become full. Okay, so there you are. That is the sutta done over two sutta classes. Any last questions about this one? Okay. Yeah. Yes, John. Yeah. Okay. So how much do we take these things with us into the next life? You take it all with you, right? Because the reason is because whatever development, the only thing that you take with you from this life to the next one is your mental development. Everything else you have to leave behind. So make sure you invest where it matters, where you can actually take with you. So that mind, whatever you leave off in this life, you continue from there, and you keep on developing your mind, you know, in the future life. No, it's not to start from scratch again. That would be terrible if you had to start from scratch again. But it is precisely because the mind is what you take with you. It is really the only thing that is worth investing in this life. Everything else is like investing in a rented house, right? Putting heaps of money, all your effort into a rented house, knowing that it will be kicked out in 3 months. That's madness, right? And you stand completely bare for 3 months. You have no money because you gave it all the way to the landowner who was a landlord who kind of owned that flat. That's basically what you're doing if you invest everything into this life and not into the future, into the kind of bigger picture of things. Yeah. Yes, Nicholas. Thank you.
Does the mental development show up in early childhood, or is it something that sort of shows up later when people get a bit older? That's sort of from previous lives.
I think it shows up in childhood as well. Yeah. It shows up all the way through. I remember, you know, somebody like Ajahn Brahm, he always tells that when he was a child, he had all these kind of times when he was just completely peaceful and at ease and relaxed. So I think it's obvious that he had some good meditation in the past life, right? I remember when I was a child, I had these ideas of living by myself in a hut in the forest. I was 12 years old. I thought, oh yeah, that would be really cool to live in a hut by myself in the forest. You know, where does it come from? And that kind of alerts you to that maybe you've been doing this in the past. So it comes all the way through. But of course, it comes in different ways, right? It's only when you're adult that you kind of take your step and become a monastic, for example, I would say. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, Eddie.
The seven
factors of... Yeah. 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 Chunda, yeah. Chunda chanted for the Buddha. Yeah. Well, I think, yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? It's very interesting. Yeah. I don't know. It just shows you something of the power of the Dhamma. It reminds you of the power of these things. And when you kind of use that power, it kind of overcomes illness, I suppose. That was Mahachunda. He was chanting it for the Buddha. And the Buddha heard it. He kind of became better as well. It's almost hard to believe, isn't it? But that's what, according to that sutta. Yeah. Oh yeah, we do it here as well. Huh? Yeah, oh yeah, sure, yeah. So when you're in hospital, Eddie, we'll chant the seven factors of awakening for you. Huh? Yeah, and then up you go, and it's you're okay again. That's the theory. So we'll see what happens. Anybody else want to say anything here? Huh? Everybody else happy? Huh? Everyone's really happy? Okay, great. So a couple of questions. So we have one from Amelie in Germany. And she says, if we all avoid the bad company, how can these people experience enlightenment if no one wants to stay with them? No one will tell them about the Buddha and the Dhamma. Yes, there is some truth to that. So it is not it's not so much about avoiding it, but I guess it is more about, you know, being, doing it in the right way. I mean, one of the great things is actually to be a teacher. To be able to teach is a wonderful thing. Obviously, you can make a lot of good karma that way if you think about it in the right way. But also, you learn a lot about the Dhamma when you teach, you know. So it's not just monastics that should be teachers. Lay people can be teachers as well. And it's a great way of actually doing that. And sometimes you have no choice. Sometimes you have to be around people who are not perfect. And when you are around people not perfect, you practice to the best of your ability. But also you know your limitations. If you are with people who drag you down all the time, eventually you get dragged down yourself. You lose your joy, you lose your happiness, you lose your ability to actually help them, right? You can only help them if you have some sense of energy inside of yourself. So you can do it, but just watch yourself, watch what's happening in your mind. And remember that, you know, you always, whenever you get dragged down, you always come back to the Dhamma, always come back to the Buddha again, and that will lift you up and kind of carry you forward on the path. So it's not that we, you know, should avoid anyone who is not an Aryan. We wouldn't have many friends if all our friends were Aryan. How many friends would you have if all your friends were Aryan? Oh, not many here. You have the Buddha, maybe one or two others in the world, but not much more. But it's just about finding the right balance. So watch your mind, see how it influences you, how it affects you, and then you will know what is right. Okay, this is from P.J. Te in Singapore. Te. If the Satipatthana nutriment are the three types of conduct, then can damaged people, for example, psychological brain damage that causes them to do bad acts, still do mindfulness practice? It really depends what you mean by mindfulness practice, and depends what you mean by satipatthana. Very often when we talk about satipatthana in the suttas, they are actually very high stages of meditation practice. They're not kind of, the way these words are used in kind of contemporary society is one thing. The way it is used in the suttas is often very, very different. They talk about mindfulness, but really what they mean ordinarily, they just mean having some degree of awareness of what you're doing, what you're thinking. That's really all they mean by mindfulness when you look at some of those contemporary techniques for dealing with problems, that sort of thing. They're not really talking about the mindfulness of the Buddha in the suttas, which is a much higher level kind of mindfulness. So it depends what you mean. But usually, I think people with, if you have some kind of brain damage or psychological damage that causes you to do bad acts, then it is not such a big problem, because a lot of that will not be intentional. It comes because of your illness or whatever. And because it comes from your illness, it will not have such a bad, negative karmic effect. You won't feel so bad about it. So all you have to do, even with those people, you have to encourage them to do the right thing, at least to the best of their ability. And then maybe, you know, to do what they can. And when they do that, then they will actually be heading in the right direction. And hopefully that will also then maybe lead those psychological problems to be reduced as a consequence. It also depends on what kind of psychological problems you have. People who are depressed, for example, or bipolar or whatever, they can often use meditation with great advantage. If you're depressed, often you need to rest a lot, you need to kind of just chill out, to get away from people and to just recharge yourself a little bit. And apparently they can often be very helped a lot by meditation practice. But remember, often for them, it's a much lower kind of meditation. It's just a meditation learning to relax, learning to be at ease, and learning to kind of just accept yourself for what you are. Self-acceptance isn't a very important part of this, like as Nicholas was saying before. And then it can be helpful. Any kind of act, right, if you are going to be kind, it demands a little bit of mindfulness. You need to know what you're doing. You need to have some awareness of what's going on. So you can see how mindfulness itself has many, many different degrees and strengths to it. Okay, I hope that is helpful. So good luck. And that's all for today. Everybody happy? Yeah, everybody good? Okay, great. Let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.